we couldn't afford to have it pushed into the background doing my job, and it wasn't, you know, I mean, I guess the fact that we were so close to the Prime Minister that people made sure that what you wanted happened. So it gave you some power. So as I said before, it's a power that you tried not to abuse, but it did give you some power, even with very senior public servants. And that particularly was evident when I would go to do an advanced survey overseas and visit our missions overseas, who were making the arrangements for the Prime Minister's visits. The word would already be down that, you know, that when the security team come in, or when I came in, you know, I probably knew more about, I probably helped them more than anybody else in the group in terms of Prime Minister's habits and what he likes and dislikes. So it wasn't only about security, it was about personal things that would make the trip run smoother for him. And so, you know, they used to welcome you with open arms and say, oh, come and talk to us about it. Because they were used to Malcolm, of course. He used to give our overseas missions a bit of a hard time. So in the early days, everybody would be quivering about a prime ministerial visit. But once I got to know Hawke, it was fine.
And another interesting angle. Did the role of the security team extend at any time beyond prime ministerial protection to more general security, in, for example, the sort of visits that you were done interstate or overseas?
Sorry, I don't quite understand.
Well, if the general, I suppose you have a certain role, which is that of personal protection of prime minister.
Yeah.
Did your role ever go beyond that in terms of security for, let's say, for a mission, rather than just for the Prime Minister? Let's say the Prime Minister brings a delegation of ministers with him. Would you have responsibility for protecting the other ministers as well?
No, but other people may. So if the Foreign Minister was going with him to somewhere where, you know, there might be a problem, or to a Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting or whatever, then we may have other people from the background, not from my team, but from, you know, maybe that worked with the VIP, general VIP area, travel overseas and particularly look after that person. Before I started with the Prime Minister, my first overseas trip was to the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Lusaka, in Zambia. In 1978, I think, 79, 78. And Fraser's team went with him. Fraser had his team. But because of the situation there, particularly the South African situation, the ANC were in Lusaka, headquartered in Lusaka, and there had been some bombings going on and all sorts of stuff, that I would send over and a couple of others to just work with the whole group. With the whole party generally, including the, you know, the head of Sir Geoffrey Yeend, who was head of Prime Minister and Cabinet and people like that. So there was two or three of us went to look after the other people that were on the trip. Yeah.
But that was not the responsibility of the Prime Minister's personal team.
No, they were there for quite the Prime separate. Minister, quite separate. Mm. Although you worked together, because often these people were there all together, so you worked together.
To protect the Prime Minister, I wonder to make sure that he was in the safest possible situation. Was your group or team ever involved in things like vetting of staff?
No.
What about visitors?
Visitors to?
To come from, let's say, a visiting group from somewhere, come to meet the Prime Minister.
No, that was all done by, that would all be done by whatever, some branch of the public service. And so, I mean, yeah, but people coming to visit the Prime Minister. I mean, AU knew in advance who was coming. If they were foreign, you know, if they were from overseas, then that would be all part of a foreign delegation being organised by the Department of Foreign Affairs and visas, and they would know the background of everybody there. So, yeah.
Generally speaking, during the period that you worked with Bob Hawke as Prime Minister, how much of an issue was security overall and during that period? Were there any actual real scares?
No, I don't. Apart from the, you know, the stuff we've talked about, demonstrations, people who were psychologically disturbed, election campaigns, we had no particular threat to the Prime Minister, no particular incidents. The only time he really nearly got injured was when he was playing cricket and got his glasses smashed by a fast playing cricket. But apart from that, no, we were. I guess I'd like to think we were lucky. I'd like to think that we had done the job properly, but that era wasn't during a time of high threat. We weren't in Iraq, we weren't in Afghanistan, you know, and all those things that would make the people that do my job, they're doing my job now. Give them far more sleepless nights than I had in those days, I think. I was there at a very lucky time.
Yes, you could say that's possible, although it must have been difficult to conceive of protecting a Prime Minister playing cricket in the middle of a wide open field.
Once again, that you take... You can't restrict people from doing everything. You don't have to in this country. I mean, we always try to operate as openly as possible to give the Prime Minister as natural a time as you could have, you know, in a way that certainly the President of the United States can't do and hasn't done for years and years and years. I wasn't at that cricket match where his glasses were smashed, but some of my team were, and they were there with their radios and the car and took him straight into hospital. That's what you're always there for. You know, he played a lot of golf. We played a lot of golf early in the morning. The easiest way for me to, or one of my team to look after the Prime Minister was to caddy for him. If you caddied for him, you couldn't get any closer than that. You were armed, you had your radio, we always had a car and a driver back at the golf club, so if anything happened on the course, you could respond, get some response immediately. And you didn't stand out. The Prime Minister could play golf without obviously being surrounded by security people. And it was all about blending in and to make him feel more comfortable about it.
In 1988, we moved up to the permanent parliament, new parliament building. What impact did that have on your work?
It made it a lot more boring than it had been to then. One of the delights of every morning at Old Parliament House was the normal doorstop. The Prime Minister always used to come to the front door up the steps, where there would be the whole press contingent waiting for him. Occasionally, when he didn't want to, had some reason not wanting to talk to the press, we used to come in the side door straight into his suite. But invariably, he would come in and answer questions. Used to be a real media scrum in the mornings. So that was, that was always an interesting start to the day. You start to the day at the new house, of course, was you drive through the gates into the Prime Ministerial courtyard, and there might be a cameraman, but there was no chance that you were ever going to get a doorstop interview. Any press stuff was always organised and pre-arranged by the press staff. So from our point of view, it was a lot safer, but a lot less interesting.
When you say a lot safer, you mean physical security?
I mean from a physical point of view, that when you were in a, you know, when you had a lot of press around you and cameras and that, I mean, there could always be other people there that, you know, you've got to try and keep an eye on them. And in fact, we had a very good rapport with the press gallery. Police generally don't welcome the press very much. However, I found them extremely useful and got on with them very well, because we used to travel overseas with them. And so I got to know them pretty well. But I can remember one morning that we were at the lodge waiting to come to the house here. And I had a phone call at the lodge, and it was Peter Harvey from Channel 9. And he said, "Oh, mate," he said, "when you come in," he said, "before you come in, you just might want to get some a uniform bloke down here to have a look at a fellow that's hanging around on the edge of the press crowd. And so I did, went down, and sure enough, there was this fellow there, and he was known to be psychologically disturbed. And so when we went in through the press, we had a couple of people there just keeping him to one side. But, you know, that fellow, I think, I can't remember whether it was that day or that week, but eventually went into the public gallery and jumped over into the floor of Parliament and broke his ankle. So you just never knew who was there, but that was an occasion where a senior member of the press went out of his way to give me a call just in case there was a problem. Because we got on so well with the press gallery, and the cameramen in particular were very useful, particularly in a demonstration. They used to like to get photographs of the demonstration, of course, the best ones they could, but, I mean, if it was really quite a crowd, they were the best battering ram you ever had. You know, if they're in front of you, they're in fact getting between you and the crowd. So, and they used to love doing it as well. They used to really enjoy that. So we had a really, really good rapport with the press. And in some of the countries, and that was because it was a two-way thing. In some countries we went overseas, there might be more restrictions on the press than you have here, and the Prime Minister's press team might want him to do something, and the foreign security, you know, wouldn't understand, wouldn't allow it. And on several occasions I managed to sort that out so that the Australian press could get the shots that the Prime Minister's office wanted and they wanted. And so that worked two ways. And I still have some really good friends in the press gallery now that I see quite often.
So this would have changed the relationship, changed when you moved up the...
Yeah, it did. Well, it changed with everybody, because here in the old house, that it was so small and everybody was so compact that everybody at some stage during the day would pass the entrance to the Prime Minister's suite, whether it was journalists or, you know, other politicians or ministers or whatever would come through. So you got to know everybody. Once you got to the new house, it was really quite sterile and enormous. And I think that this place being so small and that place, you know, that exaggerated how big it was. And whereas here, that, you know, if the Prime Minister was going to a party meeting, he travelled, you know, sort of 3 feet up the corridor to go to the party room. In the new house, you had to go up in lifts and upstairs and get lost. It was a lot different. And I think a lot of people have said that it wasn't the friendly place that.
But your role would still be the same. You'd still follow the Prime Minister.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you spent a lot more time following him around because it was so much bigger, and you were always with the parliamentary attendants in the chamber when he was but questioned Time Warner when he was in the house.
I was going to ask you about that. So there was a present from your team in the House of Reps at all times. The Prime Minister was there.
Yeah.
Where were they placed?
They would say as you enter the Reps, there's a. Well, here we just used to stand by one of the curtain doors where you could be very close to the chamber. But in the new house, as you enter, there's the recording rooms and there's where the attendants are. Do their stuff. We just stood in there. Just have somebody in there whilst the Prime Minister was on the floor of Parliament. Because you never knew what's going to happen in the gallery.
Well, that would certainly apply more perhaps here than in the new building because of the lack of any security barriers.
Yeah.
So what happened when this gentleman jumped over the...
Well, he just broke his ankle and then got jumped upon, and I wasn't there at the time, I don't think.
But there was someone from the security detail.
There would have been some. I'm pretty sure the Prime Minister was on the floor when it happened. I'm not sure that it was even on duty that day. But so it's just one of those things. I mean, you know, it's a one-off in 5 years, but that's what you're there for. You just never know when the unexpected might happen.
If you were present in the House of Representatives, would someone ever be present at, say, committee meetings? Or meeting public hearings in a committee or for that matter in the cabinet?
No. No. Used to be privy to quite a lot of stuff that went on. That's why we had the clearances we did, particularly conversations in the car with the Prime Minister, because I was used to travel in the same car as the Prime Minister. And you'd either be making telephone calls or have other people in the car, so you've got... And, you know, there were cabinet papers that he carried around, and, you know, so you're always aware of that sort of stuff. But no, I never went into the cabinet room, and neither did anybody else apart from the attendant. Public meetings, party room meetings, no. But we would know where he was. You just hang around outside. You get very used to waiting in corridors. All over the world. I've waited in the best corridors in the world, I could tell you. I've waited in corridors in the Kremlin and the Great Hall of the People. But yes, sure, public meetings. Then Labour Party conferences, we'd always have somebody not too far away.
Yeah. When you're driving, when the Prime Minister drives around in the car, there would be one of your team would be with him in the car or in a following car?
We'd have a security car behind,
yeah.
But always one person in the car with him. Person in the car with him with a radio, which would normally be me, and then the driver and how many other people you needed in the security car behind. And interstate, that car may be a federal police car or may have been a state police car. Or there may have been both, depended on what you organised for that particular function on that particular day. So,
So when the car arrives at a function, then the team will go somewhere.
Yeah, but there will already be somebody on the ground who knows exactly which direction he's going to go, so that because he doesn't know. Quite often when he jumps out of the car, he doesn't know where he's going to go, but he always pick up one of the team that he knows that will lead the way.
What happened if the Prime Minister stayed in hotels and things when he's travelling around?
We have a security room next door to him, which is manned 24 hours a day. And when we travelled overseas, I would invariably have the suite next door to his, or the room next door to his, so I had direct access to him. But my fellows would normally be on the same floor, but there would always be 24-hour security on that floor of the hotel, which was normally manned by the host government. But that was just par for the course wherever you went.
Well, the relationship between when on overseas visits between yourself as the PM's personal protection and the overseas the overseas country's security,
yep.
Where did the demarcation? What was the demarcation between?
Well. Your visitor there in their country, that's their responsibility. The protection of the Prime Minister is their responsibility. you don't have any legal powers in their country at all, but you would go ahead and assess how good the security was. And of course, if you went to the States, you know, the Prime Minister of Australia will get the same protection as the Vice President of the United States, the same level of protection as the Vice President. They would spend more money on a 5-day visit to the United States on our Prime Minister's security than we would spend in a year. It was just extraordinary. But if you went to some third world country, then in fact you may decide to take more people yourself, because although you would have the foreign security there, you would think that their equipment, their cars and whatever might not be up to it. I mean, there's more than one occasion when I've been overseas where the security supplied by the host government was, just worse than useless. And so we would either get our ambassador, pinch our ambassador's car, or get one of the, or hire one or whatever, and use that as a security car.
Would you, in those sort of circumstances, would you be carrying your own arms, or would you?
Depends on, it would depend on the country you were going to and whether you had permission to take it. You'd always ask for permission to take it. But again, that would depend, you know, you didn't need really to take it to the States, but they insisted that you did because that's where they are. But with the UK, never armed in the UK, and you know they don't expect to be armed when they're in Australia, when from the UK. I mean, it's so you have to be worried about the reciprocal thing as well, that you would go to a country, because we don't normally. I mean, the policy in Australia is that we don't let foreign policemen come in armed. But it makes it difficult if you go to their country and carry a firearm, and they say, well, we let your fellow in with a firearm, why can't we do it in your country? And so, I mean, part of my job was to assess the standard of security and how confident I was that they could do a good job. And
any examples of countries or places or times when you really struck problems with when visiting overseas?
I mean, a lot of countries have improved their security, but obviously some of the South Pacific Islands, although there wasn't a great deal of risk there, but I mean, there was this great. You always asked in advance for permission to carry a firearm, and one year, in the 80s, sometime, the South Pacific Forum was in the Cook Islands, and we contacted the Cook Islands to see if we could bring a firearm in, and the reply from the Cook Islands was yes, please, because we only have one. Other countries, I mean, they just don't have the equipment or the training, I don't know what PNG is like now, but in the early days. We had a security car that couldn't keep up with the Prime Minister's car. You know, we just wouldn't go. So we hired our own car. First time I went, 1983, in Hawke's first year in 1983, the Commonwealth Heads of Government was on in New Delhi, which was an interesting trip all round. But the security car there was, I don't know if you know, but, you know, in those days they used to turn out all the Morris Minors from the old things, you know, so you could have a brand new Morris Minor, but, you know, the dies were from 1947 when British Motors or whoever it was gave them to the Indian government, so there was, I used to, and our security officers, I think, were chosen, it sounds just elitist, but it's not meant to be. I don't know how they chose the security officers for each of the heads of state. But we had one fellow sitting in the back of the car, this old Morris in the back of the car with a 303 rifle, that he used to sit in the back with the rifle in between his knees with the muzzle up underneath his chin as we were bouncing along. So we didn't use that for very long. We contacted our High Commissioner over there and said, we need a car, please. So, but then you go to the States and you get, 40, 50 Secret Service agents a day working with you. So, it was Great fun. Very interesting.
Can we take a short break now?
Yes, I'd love to. So I'll talk about the first trip to India.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, we resumed again. We were talking about the overseas visits and security that you had to provide in those circumstances. You had an interesting story to tell about the funeral of Indira Gandhi.
Yes. Indira Gandhi, of course, was assassinated in 1984. And as usual, when a head of state or is assassinated, then the funeral arrangements are made at very short notice. Hawke couldn't go to the funeral, so they decided that Australia would be represented by Lionel Bowen, who was Deputy Prime Minister, and Sir Ninian Stephen, the Governor General. And I was lucky enough to travel with them at very, very short notice into New Delhi. And I mean, it was a nightmare from a security point of view that there were assassins had been her Sikh bodyguards, and millions of people can gather in a very short time in a place like India, and did. And so we flew in. We were only going to be in the country for one night. We were going to be in and out in less than 24 hours. We flew in, and I met with our High Commission people who told me that the next morning that we would be taken by our ambassador, our High Commissioner's car, to a sports stadium, and where every visitor to the funeral, every head of state, head of government coming to the funeral from all over the world, would gather, and there would be then buses to bus those people, all the visitors, to the funeral site, which was in the middle of a park, some distance away. So the first bit went very well in our High Commissioner's car. We got to the sports stadium, where there were where we joined the bus queue. There was me and a colleague and Deputy Prime Minister Bowen, the Governor General Sir Ninian Stephen, and we joined the queue. Immediately in front of us was Mr. Nakasone, the Prime Minister of Japan, and his security officers. And immediately in front of him was Yasser Arafat and his security officers. And as we shuffled forward, a bus came along, and of course these Indian buses have very, very narrow doorways for some reason. I don't know why, but always seem to have very narrow doorways. And as we moved forward, both Nakasone and Arafat went to get on at the same time, to the dismay of both their lots of security officers, who then started pulling the other one out of the way so their man could get on first. And I turned to the Governor General and I said, Governor General, I think we might just wait for the next bus to come along. And he said, that's a good idea, Superintendent. And so we had this amazing scene of these two lots of security officers, not knowing, I don't think, who the other VIP was, having a scuffle trying to get their person on the bus first. But anyway, off we went, and off to the funeral site, and there in this park, there are all these chairs laid out for the VIPs, and they had done it in alphabetical order. So, being A for Australia, we had a front row seat at the funeral pyre, which was this, you know, huge pile of sandalwood logs and all the seats. And the seats in the centre were reserved for Princess Anne, who was representing the Queen, and Margaret Thatcher. And they were the only ones with designated seats apart from alphabet. So we were, you know, two seats away from the British Prime Minister and Princess Anne. And the security people, who I knew very well from having worked with them in various parts of the world over the years. And so we sort of got together but just prior to Princess Anne arriving, we heard this voice, a little lady's voice, saying, make way for the First Lady, make way for the First Lady. And there was this Filipino lady escorting Imelda Marcos, who intended to sit in Princess Anne's seat at the front, and so there was a diplomatic incident there where they managed to shuffle up to one of the back rows where the peas were, Philippines. And eventually Margaret Thatcher and Princess Anne came, and then there was this extraordinary, and I'll never forget it, this extraordinary funeral where Indira Gandhi was brought in with literally tens of thousands of people following the funeral cortege, where they were burying, covered in marigolds, and then they laid her on top of this huge sandalwood pyre, funeral pyre, and the family, I mean, Rajiv Gandhi and the rest of the family, then walked round and then actually tipped accelerant on the fire to get it going, which was quite extraordinary, because what the Indians do extremely well is make all these beautiful brass pots and all that sort of things, but the accelerants were in sort of 4-litre cans, and you know, it was just incongruous seeing Rajiv Gandhi with a can of accelerant in his hand, sort of splashing it on his mother's funeral pyre so it would catch light. But anyway, as soon as that was over, we just headed straight from the airport and got out of it, because there was great potential for problems there, for riots in New Delhi, of millions of people, and the only thing to do was get out as soon as we could. So I think we went straight from the funeral straight to the airport and flew back to Australia. But it was a
nightmare for security.
Sorry, an absolute nightmare, and nothing you could do. I mean, there was absolutely nothing you could do if something had gone wrong, apart from we had one person stay back and in contact with us, so that if things had gone wrong, we had somebody to contact to, and hopefully the High Commission could have, you know, got us out of there. But I doubt even that could have happened with the literally tens of thousands of people. And the potential for a riot was huge. But it all went off all right, but there was no chance of planning that one. Yeah.
Is that, makes the question in terms of personal protection. What was it like in the years we're talking about, you know, and was it modelled on anything that was done in other countries like the US or the UK?
No, I mean, the Brits and us and the Canadians seem to work in a very similar fashion. The Americans, of course, and probably had more reason than anybody else to have enormous amounts of security. I mean, that most other countries could not afford. The United States Secret Service were probably certainly the most efficient at what they do. But they just pour numbers into it, yeah, literally. I've worked with them in the States and I've worked with them in Australia several times, and they just pour people and equipment into looking after the thing and leaving absolutely nothing to chance. But they're very good at what they do. And if you're talking about security, then they are the best. It just wouldn't be acceptable in our society. I guess they get used to it in the States, but the infringement on public freedom around any of their operations is quite extraordinary, whether they're in their own country or not. But of course, if you don't do it their way, then they have the power to say, well, the president's not coming. And that's never politically acceptable for any country where a US president's going, I would assume. The Russians tried to... I went to Moscow in the late 80s with the Prime Minister. They seemed to be trying to emulate their American counterparts. They weren't as professional, but they were very good, and I got on... It's the KGB that do the job over there, and their protection people I got on extremely well with. They were... very interesting and very helpful. Worked under some, you know, extreme conditions, because they didn't have the money to splash around on security. But you know, we were made very welcome and made to feel very safe. Some of the third world countries we went to obviously weren't so good, and so the whole idea of going in advance and assessing the security in various countries is a very important part of the trip, and so you can assess whether you need to take more people or whether you can rely on the security forces. So, but most countries are pretty good, I mean, I found, and always very helpful, and there's certainly a camaraderie amongst, I mean, cops worldwide, I guess it's a great club. And you're always made to feel welcome in most places you went.
So would you say that the Prime Minister's personal protection, is it an Australian model, or is it sort of more akin to the British model, perhaps?
No, I think we've got our own Australian model. We aren't as formal as a nation as the Brits, so that intends to... that doesn't mean that affects the efficiency of the thing, but formality wise, we get on pretty well. I can remember the Commonwealth Heads of Government in the Bahamas. The weekend retreat was in one of the